Hello and welcome to our Road to Glasgow podcast. We have a fantastic episode lined up for you today. I'm joined by Richard Halsey, who's the Capabilities Director from the Energy Systems Catapult, and my colleague, a perennial colleague from the Net Zero Technology Centre, Luca Corradi. So without further ado, let's introduce the guys and we'll dive right into the topic in hand, which is hydrogen energy systems integration, the work of the Energy Systems Catapult, and of course, COP26. Hello, Richard. Would you want to say a few words about yourself and your role?
Yeah, thank you. As you said, I am Richard Halsey, Capabilities Director at the Energy Systems Catapult. I head a wide and kind of diverse range of kind of capabilities within the Catapult that supports wider energy system transformation, but I'll perhaps touch on a little bit more in a second around the Catapult and what it's doing. So nice to be here and look forward to the conversation.
Super, thanks, Richard. And Luca, hello again.
Hello. Hi, Richard. We're here with Richard. I've been working with Richard for a few months now on a couple of initiatives, but I think it'd be great to start with the concept of the energy system, right? So you're part of an energy system catapult. And maybe for some of our listening, explaining what is a catapult and what is the energy system catapult? What do they do?
Yeah, great. I know this question obviously sort of asks quite a lot. So we are one of the wider network of catapult innovation centres that are set up, I suppose, to tackle particular areas of opportunity or challenge for innovation and drive forward innovation in the UK in those particular areas. Our remit is obviously a strong focus on the energy systems transformation and the opportunities that the net zero agenda, the transformation of our energy system represents. And the way that we tend to think about that is with regard how we can help and support innovators to develop and deliver new energy products and services, but also in parallel how we need to transform our local energy systems, our national energy systems, and create new markets that can kind of unlock innovation, drive decarbonisation. So we've got quite a wide remit, and we're working quite closely as part of the wider innovations ecosystem as well, with academia, with industry, with other kind of innovation and technology centres, kind of like yourselves, Luca.
That's great, and I guess you know your work then is used to influence or to direct, inform policies and strategies, both in governments and especially, in, I guess, in the networks operators, right?
Yeah, very, very much so. So we obviously work quite closely with government, the range of kind of network operators as part of the energy system to try and figure out how things can work in the future, how they can fit together. And one of our key focus points is thinking and trying to think about the whole system. So rather than thinking about individual components of the system, but how these things are all going to work together. And obviously, we see that as increasingly important as we start to decarbonize, as we start to see new technologies kind of coming into play as part of the energy system. How do they all fit together? How do we make sure that works for people and for businesses? How do we make sure also that when we fit it all together, it all adds up to a kind of low carbon, secure, reliable kind of energy system and gives us the outcomes that we all want as well?
And I think you mentioned people, which is probably an angle I would like to start with, because we are the Net Zero Technology Center. You know, we focus on the technology innovation, and we realize ourselves that often having a good technology that works is not enough, and the adoption requires a number of other factors from people, from culture, from a psychological factor, and we did recently an interesting study about that. Policy behavior being focused on the production side, we don't deal much with the consumer while you do, right? So how important is the consumer in the transition, what is the relationship of the consumer with the technology innovation that we are all working on? Because that I think that's an interesting topic, because in a way, so far, the easy decarbonization has been done without the consumer really having anything to do with it, except maybe a little bit of increase in the bill. But that was the easy part of decarbonizing power. The moment we start decarbonizing transport, heating, changing behaviors in order to get net zero, that psychological, individual, people side becomes more important. You do a lot of work on that side, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's. I think you sort of hit the nail on the head there. That there's a really important aspect to the transition, and we've made some fantastic progress in decarbonising our power sector, in kind of integrating renewable technologies at different scales, at delivering more distributed generation, even now increasingly sort of embedding sort of storage solutions, and kind of driving that forward. But you're absolutely spot on that the next phase of decarbonisation is going to get much closer to us as people, to businesses, and it's going to require us to kind of be able to face and front into that. And for me, it's a real key part of the innovation need is really understanding how you can develop and deliver solutions that people both value and ideally that they want, that we get some not only some technology push, but we get some demand pull from consumers. And that, I think, is very much about developing innovative new energy products and services that can work for people and that recognizes kind of the things that they value. There are aspects of the things that we have now that aren't great, that could be better. There are things that we do a lot of work with, obviously directly with consumers at the Catapult. We've created a living lab of connected homes where we have many hundreds of people across the country connected, kind of almost as part of a kind of digital ecosystem, and we work with innovators to try new energy products and services and help understand how people value them, how they respond to them, how they use them, and I think there's a really fantastic opportunity with the digitalization of energy to better understand what people want and also to deliver better outcomes for people through new technologies. So it is a really big challenge. A lot of these things are going to get into our faces more. They affect our houses. They affect how we move about. They potentially affect our perceptions of value and aesthetics and various other things. So it gets into a space that is going to require us all to engage with much more. But whilst, as I said, I think a key thing for me is whilst that is challenging, it isn't without opportunities and opportunities for innovation, which we do feel are really important. We have a dedicated consumer team at the Energy Systems Capital that specialises in understanding how people engage with energy, what they value, and what they want. And we think kind of taking that lens and applying that perspective can be really valuable and important in driving technology development as well as solution development for various different scales and in various different contexts.
I'm fascinated by this lab or experiment, you say, connected people. It's a sort of a big brother to reality show on the energy-related habits. I guess you don't have cameras, but you're monitoring their consumption and usage. Can you make a few examples of these products and solutions that you're testing that are more closer to people or that people have more?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, very much so. So yeah, as you say, it's almost like a kind of a slightly less dramatic kind of big brother, I suppose. But yeah, so people distributed, different households, different house types, different obviously geographies, have homes that are instrumented with kind of currently commercially available kind of technologies to get data and information with them. They have access to the Catapult through a digital portal, which then allows us to, on behalf of innovators, kind of connect them with new products and services. So, for example, we have developed new heat services and with various companies, and we have then, in effect, tested those with a sample of those homes. So we've offered them a heat service. Some of them have then, in effect, bought that heat service kind of in a kind of quasi sort of faux manner, and we've then learned about how they use energy, what that means, whether the service is viable, whether it delivers benefit, how they've reacted to it. Kind of the other end of the spectrum, we've kind of tested a range of kind of control technologies that allow people to kind of control their heating and kind of energy at home in different ways. We've done something with one innovator which was about a kind of novel air brick that was basically kind of providing a mechanism for allowing ventilation into the house in a slightly different way. And it provides an environment that is more real, because it's obviously real people just going about their daily lives, and then those products, services are kind of functioning in that real environment. And it allows us to understand how they might then scale, for example. So we connect that lab environment with our simulation tools to think about, well, what might happen if this technology scaled up what might happen if those, that instead of having 100 of those units, what happened if it, what might happen if it was 100,000 or 200,000 or a million of those units? What might that look like? And obviously we talk to these people, we get feedback on what, you know, what did they like, what did they not like. We have a sort of connected panel of people as well that are outside the experiment, so we can try and bounce ideas off people that are involved and not involved. So it provides us quite a powerful way of really trying to understand what people want and value and what might work, and helping businesses hopefully develop and launch to market some great new products and services.
How important is the cost? Because, you know, we've seen the spikes in the bills recently, that's for the global gas markets, but clearly a lot of this decarbonization has a cost, you know, and it's a result of the fact that at the moment we're not counting the true cost of using fossil fuels for the environment, for the planet. But, you know, someone has to pay for this increase in the cost in the bill. And so what is the attitude of the people that are, or the customers that you're monitoring?
It's a really good question. I mean, cost is a really important factor for some people, without doubt. It is one of the overriding factors in some cases to their energy use and their energy consumption and what they do. However, you know, that varies across different segments. So cost isn't the overriding factor and the only consideration for every segment. There are a range of segments of obviously households and consumers, and they have different values, they have different drivers, they have different needs, some value comfort, convenience, accessibility more than they do cost. Some really cost is the factor. There is nothing else. There's a wide spectrum of in between. There are price points and differentiators where people feel that actually it's comfortable to pay a little bit more, or maybe they don't see enough value and aren't willing to pay enough more. So it's quite a complex landscape, but it certainly is for some some customers a really important factor. And in terms of innovating, you know, the opportunities to kind of obviously reduce cost or deliver better outcomes and value is clearly where there's a big opportunity for innovation to help drive the transition and to drive people pulling kind of low carbon solutions through.
I think you mentioned scale before, and one of the things that has been very popular in waves in recent years is the concept of distributed energy or decentralized energy or the prosumer. So the household that produces electricity through solar panels and use it and share within the community. So it seems to come in waves, as I said, right? So it becomes popular. But logically, I have a question, which is, you know, clearly you need to create slack in the system. You need to create some inefficiency to cover up for the variation in demand and in supply. And a small community system requires a lot of slack, that if you put them together, it is more than the centralized one. So is a centralized system better, more efficient than a network, or is it distributed versus centralized, or distributed and centralized the direction to go for energy system?
Yeah, I think again, it's a really good question, and there's probably a number of lenses on the sort of centralized versus decentralized. Obviously, we're kind of living in a world now where we have kind of aspects of centralization and aspects of decentralization together, and I think kind of going forward, it's highly likely that we will have this kind of blended kind of system. We will have aspects of decentralization kind of embedded within a national construct. For we have to ensure that demand and supply are kind of in balance, and that the system is secure, and that we have the mechanisms to ensure that we can cope with kind of emergency situations, that we have the right control systems in place. What's going to be really important as we start to see more energy assets and more intelligent energy assets coming on and being part of the system is ensuring that they are able to be interoperable to some extent, and we are able to control them effectively. A lot of the potential benefits of decentralization are the ability to aggregate many of those assets to provide flexibility to the system, or to use energy that is perhaps being underutilized historically. But obviously, to achieve that, we need to find the ways that the system and those parts of the system can kind of talk to one another. And also that obviously people are accepting of any interventions that might relate to their resources. If you are if the network is going to require me to turn down my heating or to not have access to my charging for my electric vehicle or to not have kind of hot water between a particular time, obviously I as a consumer need to be happy that I'm going to kind of give up that flexibility. But I think that's going to be a really important part of, again, of the kind of innovation and research agenda over the next few years. How can we make a system that can have the best of both worlds? And obviously, as you sort of alluded to earlier, is cost effective for us all as consumers. What we want is a decarbonized, safe, secure and cost effective system. And sometimes that means parts of the system, you know, kind of aren't necessarily the cheapest, because overall, when they're kind of put together, it makes sense from a whole system perspective and delivering, an acceptable cost to consumers.
And on the cost effective, of course, that's a topic, close to our heart, because what we focus on at the Net Zero Technology Center is innovation to make an affordable transition and for reducing the cost. And one of the things that we are investing a lot and a lot of work and effort is hydrogen. And so hydrogen, we see that not being the panacea. It has a lot of limitation, but a lot of advantages, especially in that concept of blended or integrated system with electrification. Right? So what's the energy system view on hydrogen? You know, is it going to be a relevant part of the future energy system? There's a lot of debate about hydrogen versus electrification. I'm hoping that we are moving away from that, because I think it is hydrogen and electrification working in a system plus other components that are the part of a one size fits all. But you know, how much is hydrogen within the system that you foresee? And maybe that's a loaded question, because I know you're part also the Hydrogen Advisory Council or to inform the hydrogen strategy. So, but you know, maybe some highlight on the direction of travel for the UK in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, a great question. I mean, as you know, looking at the system, from our perspective, hydrogen, looks like it's going to play an important role in getting us to net zero. We have to recognise there's quite a lot of uncertainty. There's quite a lot of ground to be kind of covered for us to kind of grow the role of hydrogen in the near term, but ultimately in the long term. Certainly looking out in the longer term, and when we think about net zero in a system context, hydrogen looks to play a really, really important role. Some of our sort of whole system modeling and analysis using our energy system modeling environment suggests, hydrogen could grow to be, the size of the power sector that we have today. Which is a significant increase from obviously where we are today. There is a high degree of uncertainty around the application, particularly of hydrogen, and where it would represent the most value and benefit for the UK's energy system. But that is also obviously a global debate about where should we be using hydrogen. We see potential near-term value, particularly in kind of hard to decarbonize industrial applications, aspects of mobility, that look like it has potentially higher value, and there are a range of options in terms of its application. So we certainly see it playing a really, really important role going forward. But collectively we have to recognise that there's some uncertainty around that, and ensure that we are kind of taking the steps to move things forward in a kind of structured way. I think, obviously, as I would say, at the Energy Systems Catapult, I think the thing that we think is really important is that we see hydrogen as an integrated part of the energy system rather than something as a standalone aspect. It's quite different to, just a single electricity generating technology, where we've got to figure out how both we produce it, how we move it about and distribute it, but then also how we connect it to valuable uses. And obviously, at the moment, we have a relatively limited pool of uses, and we have a relatively limited base of generation, which obviously, the likes of yourselves are working on how can we kind of develop and drive new technologies to kind of be able to produce hydrogen potentially more cost effectively. And we just need to make sure that we've got that connection in to how we can actually use it and apply it in the right context.
And that's the classic chicken and egg situation, right? So end-to-end situation. How do we give comfort to potential hydrogen producers that all the hydrogen they produce will find a way to market, both physically and economically? You know, and how do we give confidence to the developers or producers of hydrogen-based appliances, made at boilers or engines or fuel cells, that they will have an available and distributed source of hydrogen for that? And of course, the thing in the middle, which is very important. I would like to do a little game of quick fire of sectors that needs to be decarbonized, and what are the key technologies competing for that solution or maybe collaborating for that solution. So if you go for heating, it's going to be heat pump, hydrogen, gas with CCS, biofuels. What is the solution
for heat? Yeah, I mean, heating, I think, is the really topical one and one where there is kind of high degree of uncertainty. The options that are on the table, as you suggest, certainly comprise the potential full repurposing of the gas grid to supply hydrogen into hydrogen boilers, obviously the full electrification of heating of our homes in combination with targeted sort of retrofit interventions to kind of manage demand. And that electrification could come in many forms. It could be kind of direct electric heating. It could be more sophisticated kind of forms of electric heating. It could be obviously heat pumps in various different configurations, whether it's high temperature air source heat pumps or ground source heat pumps. But also there are other solutions like hybrid heating systems that could combine low carbon, zero carbon gases and electric heating in a kind of optimized solution, which we're seeing a number of kind of organizations looking at and considering. We have district heating, which is arguably not a sort of technology in its own right, but it's just another a mechanism of distributing heat to homes in the UK, which could use a wide variety of different technologies. So that could be big energy centres with big heat pumps in. It could be big energy centres with big hydrogen boilers in. It could be energy centres with big heat pumps and hydrogen boilers in combinations in between. So I think we've got work to do to figure out exactly what the solutions might be. And an important factor of that, I think, is going to be kind of the realities of place and geography. So we might start to see a more sophisticated mix of different heating technologies in different places that align to the infrastructure sort of transition in those places as well. So I think at this stage, it's very difficult to say this is the answer. There's lots of work going on. There's lots of need for innovation. BEIS is kind of got a large program of work looking specifically at hydrogen for heat, and obviously their concept of looking at a hydrogen village and then ultimately a hydrogen town. BEIS has also got an electrification of heat demonstration program that we're, so Catapult is kind of closely involved with and supporting as well. I think at this point I can't kind of make the call. There's probably a narrowing selection, and there will come points in time where we will have to make decisions around infrastructure, but I think we're probably in the period now where we just need to try and develop and prove the solutions, build and understand, drive innovation. You talked earlier, Luca, about cost in heating. One of the key factors is obviously cost, and how is that cost going to be borne by consumers, but also how can we make these solutions really work for people? How can we make sure that they're confident in the solutions, that they value them, and that we can, the supply chain as well can be built and to get those technologies into homes. Sorry if I'm sitting on the fence.
No, absolutely. too early to call a winner, but I totally agree with you on the need for innovation and cost reduction. One of the mantras I normally use is that we need to start deploying at scale, but innovate at the same time. And the two things go hand in hand. Because you can reduce the cost by learning by doing and through economy of scale. Up to a certain point, but the big transformational change in cost comes from innovation and research and testing new stuff. So we cover heating. What about transportation? In Aberdeen we have a fleet of hydrogen buses and public service bin lorries and other utility vehicles. Is private transportation and city transportation, hydrogen, electric, hybrid? Where do you see going?
Yeah, and I think again on that one, you can certainly see a value of hydrogen application in heavy goods. You know, where electrification looks like it's potentially quite hard and very expensive. You can see a kind of a potential real value for hydrogen. I think there's probably more debate as you kind of come downstream to smaller vehicles about how is the market going to evolve, how are consumer demands going to evolve with different technologies, and the cost effective application of hydrogen as a commodity. I think again it's an area where I can see value in progressing and developing solutions, testing. I think ultimately, in terms of the volume of application of hydrogen, that's highly likely to be dictated by its cost effectiveness in that context, how the products that whether it's the buses, the HGVs, are represent a good mobility outcome and solution for the people that are going to use them. So I think passenger vehicles. Particularly smaller passenger vehicles. Obviously, the electric vehicle market is moving forward at some pace. A lot of the products that are coming forward, seem to have a degree of consumer appeal and pull. As you kind of move up the scale of vehicle, you start to get into space where hydrogen feels like it could have much more a kind of value. But we obviously don't know how post-COVID the sort of mobility and the need for kind of vehicles and how that's going to evolve as well. So there's a number of factors at play, but certainly seems like in some applications, could have a really valuable and important role.
Do you focus work on also on the industry? Of course, we do a lot on the industrial decarbonization. We partner with the Nexus Alliance, looking at the Scottish cluster, but also dealing with the IDRIC and across the various clusters. And of course, that's a difficult one because the way that we have reduced the emission from industrial in the past has been biofueling production to some other country, and importing back the product, which does nothing for the climate, but does a lot of bad thing for jobs. So we're not going that direction. The CCC report and recommendation are clear on that. So that is, again, potentially hydrogen, is carbon capture, is electrification, but it's more complex.
Yeah, I think that for me in hydrogen is a really important area. As similar to yourselves, we're doing work, in terms of thinking about some of the road mapping around the industrial clusters and how how that might sort of plan out. And obviously thinking about that from a system perspective, so you could, you can see, and I guess in some industrial process applications, your options space is quite narrow compared to some of the other kind of applications. So hydrogen feels like it has a really valuable and important role there. It also feels like from a practical delivery perspective, there are ways and means that you can develop almost, sort of little early end-to-end value chains and supply chain sort of relationships that can kind of start to grow and stimulate that kind of production into use kind of relationships. So I think it is a really important part of kind of developing hydrogen in the UK. Again, what we just need to be thinking about a little bit is how will that then fit as part of the wider local energy system where those industrial clusters might sit? And ultimately then how might that knit together for the UK as a whole? Might we see, clusters, kind of growing a nucleus of hydrogen areas where hydrogen actually then develops and expands and provides infrastructure more widely? Can it provide that nucleus? Or does it help us kind of really concentrate, and apply a commodity into its highest value applications in terms of decarbonisation? Again, a lot of this stuff is going to be about learning, about innovating, about trying to understand how can different technologies kind of come together. Carbon capture and storage, as you say, is obviously really important if we think, if blue hydrogen is going to play a big role in the UK's energy system and delivering net zero. That's an area where maybe progress really hasn't been what many of us kind of had of hope for, perhaps, kind of looking back, sort of 10 years or more, but certainly is an important area. When you look at net zero from a system perspective, it looks really hard. And I think we can't get away from that. It's very easy for any of us to say, I want to be net zero, I want to live in net zero. But when you actually have dealt with the realities of what a net zero energy system needs to be, it looks very, very difficult. And I don't like the idea of taking options off the table as well. Until they are taken, or until the your inability to make a decision is kind of more adverse than having the option on the table. So I think there is something really important around that, and those industrial clusters are going to play a really important part in helping us kind of move some of that forward.
Interesting, because one of the situations in which taking options off the table, but it's not taking an innovative option, taking the old option, seems to be working is in car transportation, right? So the banning the sales of diesel and petrol vehicle from a certain date, you know, of course, is a reasonable date that allows for planning, then gives some certainty to industry and to car manufacturers, to investors in infrastructure for network and recharging, to make the investment. And that's what basically we can say drove the acceleration of electric vehicles availability and selling and adoption. So should we have the same approach for heating, putting a date for boilers, for industry somehow, for air travel, which is maybe air travel is another topic we haven't touched upon, yeah. Which is combine a very, very, very difficult decarbonization effort, because it's very difficult to replace the energy density of air fuel with anything else. But at the same time, involves a lot of consumer and behavior. So could that be an option? Or
yeah, I mean, obviously, policy sticks are always available to governments to stop something or to drive businesses and consumers in a particular direction. I think that one of the differences I always think with the electric vehicle position is that there are great products now that people actually want. You know, so we all, you know, if you were to say to me, do you want one of these wonderful electric vehicles over here, parking whether you can afford it or not, would you want it compared to the car that you've got on the drive? I would kind of, you know, I think a lot of us would nod our head and say, yes, please. Thank you very much. That looks fabulous. That looks wonderful. I think one of the challenges is how do we make sure that there are products and services that are equivalent or better to what consumers have today available to them? You know, so that, you know, because that's where I think we have the policy implementation challenges. If people are told you can't do this, and they're not given an alternative, you know, an equivalent that they can kind of get to grips with and deal with, or ideally that they potentially want and would value, it becomes a lot more difficult. So I think that's why, you know, it's highly likely that we're going to need an evolutionary sort of policy environment, particularly around heating. You know, we obviously want to see signals, direction of travel, and I think we have got some of that from government in the UK, at least, around the intent. I think we will, you know, gradually start to need to see ratcheting up of the kind of strength of the policy kind of instruments, and some of that should relate to how we start to see change. If we don't start to see progress, if we don't start to see uptake with supporting incentives and initiatives, et cetera, then obviously those policy levers potentially have to become much harder. But I think the really important point there is about, you know, if you're going to take something away, you've got to have something to kind of go back in its place. And we've seen that in kind of other contexts. And, you know, EVs is a really great example. There was a lot of private and public investment in the technology, in research, in innovation, in the products for a long time before we got to a position of banning ICEs in 2030. So I don't think we can necessarily underestimate what's needed in that space as well.
I think it's overwhelming for a lot of people, though. You know, when you listen to this conversation, and others and other conversations talk about the necessity to travel faster, harder to achieve net zero, quicker than everyone is kind of saying we need to in terms of the timelines the government is talking about. Otherwise, we'll be in disaster zone. That scares people, and I think some folk actually relish that anxiety-inducing argument. They really promote it and they stimulate it. The reality is that there's going to be a lot of changes over the next 15 to 20 years that will happen almost below the line in terms of awareness to consumers, I think, my opinion, because it's a bit like LED light bulbs. You know, the technology gets developed and before you know it, there's a policy drive and a standard that makes you change all your light bulbs in your house gradually over time. And when you think about it, we've got still a runway to go to actually decarbonize heating in the home. We've got a runway to go down in terms of decarbonizing heating on transportation. These things won't happen overnight. And folk will get used to technology changes because it'll almost be, you know, okay, I have to buy this LED light bulb now. What's the difference? Oh, it doesn't shine as brightly as the other one used to shine, but I can live with it.
Yeah.
There's a gradual acceptance of the change.
I think you're absolutely spot on, Stephen. And I think, you know, sometimes we, you know, as you say, the LEDs is a prime example. It costs me a lot more now than it did historically to go and buy a light bulb from the hardware store where my light goes. But generally, my light that lasts longer. I have more options. I can control some of my lights because some of them are kind of Wi-Fi enabled. So there's all kind of benefits that I've got. Yeah. But as you say, we as a society have kind of become accepting of that, and you know, industry has evolved and developed to deliver products that work. And I think there will be kind of aspects of that in the transition. I also, you know, I passionately personally believe that, you know, we want a future net zero world to be better. You know, I want it to, you know, to deliver more comfort for people, for us to have a system that's more effective and efficient, to people to have more choice and options around the things that they might do, you know, that their mobility is enhanced and their ability to make choices. So that I think if we sometimes we almost focus on the challenge, and actually, you know, if we can potentially sort of highlight the opportunity for creating a better places, better ways of living, better solutions for people, I think actually that's what chimes with people. That's what people want to kind of connect with and engage with. You're probably right, Stephen, that there's always a sort of section that wants to kind of highlight how impossible and how difficult and how people are going to resist. But I certainly like to think that the positive generally will always trump the negative. And if we can sort of try and sort of synergize around a vision for what a net zero future looks like, that is probably the thing that will actually energize, particularly younger generations, around the place that they want to see, place that they want to live in. But equally, you're perfectly right. Though some of this stuff will not be visible to most of us. We are incredible at developing solutions. You know, I was, for, you know, sort of coming back late one evening a couple of weeks ago, and there was a gang of gas engineers out in the middle of the night, obviously repurposing, changing a problem with a bit of pipe work that had gone and happened, you know, so whether it was a leak, you know, something, a safety control, something had happened. And literally, you know, I walked back the same street the following morning. It was like they were never there, you know, and it was incredible. You know, it was this team, a huge team of people there. And you know, I think sometimes we forget how, you know, incredible we are at making things happen. And also how, you know, great at innovating and driving things, you know, getting things, the cost down, as you said, but coming up with solutions to problems. Yeah. You know, I think we are incredible in that regard.
You read lots of reports about this kind of stuff in our line of work, Richard. I know you do as well. And, you know, I read a really interesting thing from the Tony Blair Institute. You know, take it as you will, but the Tony Blair Institute have been doing some interesting work on behavior change, you know, going back to the conversation that we were having previously about behavior change. And they've modeled a few of the behaviors that are needed to be changed. And one of them is active transport. So the behavior change required is to increase walking, cycling, public transport in place of car usage. And the model that they are using says that in reality, what they need to do is just reduce car kilometers per driver by about 4% over the next 15 years. That will really kind of work towards achieving net zero by the target date. And the other one is air travel. Look, you were mentioning air travel, and one of the stats that they've modeled is that obviously you want to reduce international travel and domestic flights. They want to see plane kilometres per person or passenger kilometres reduced by 6% in order to reduce net zero. Now, in 2019, there were 8 billion passenger kilometre flights. People travelled 8 billion kilometres per passenger. I mean, not per passenger, but in total. So those measures don't seem terribly restrictive. I mean, it's not like you're saying you can't go on your holiday anymore. You just have to be selective.
Yeah, and I think that's the key point there, sort of, Stephen. It's we've seen in COVID how dramatic the emissions reduction from transport, from aviation has kind of been as a result of shifts time working. But obviously, if you were to say to people, is that the world that you want to live in? But making those shifts, trying to sort of ensure that those shifts, stick. Sometimes can be, quite often we see that there has been tweaks to behaviours, but then growth, the volume of people that are flying, the volume of people that are moving about. You've got this kind of constant counterweight that you're almost fighting against. You've got more people, you've got more movement. So even if people decline, so you have to try and ensure that not only if you got some of those kind of small stuff done, some of the stuff though is also quite hard to get to net zero. That I think that's the challenge. It's we've got to get all of these things to add up. And certainly though, I think you do get a sense of and some of this might not necessarily be always borne out in the evidence, but you get a sense from the climate assemblies, from the way that people are engaging around the climate change agenda, that there is a desire to engage with the issues, to connect. We're seeing it with our work with local authorities across the UK, so many of them really leading and driving the decarbonisation agenda, wanting to do stuff. But that's then got to bear out into kind of action and change kind of on the ground. And sometimes, it's the kind of fine margins at the end. It's the hard yards. We started the conversation about how we've done some of the easy stuff. As you kind of creep up the line, it gets harder, it gets more difficult, and obviously the margins become, so just a smaller pound becomes a bigger contribution to your emissions, and that's where net zero gets tough, I think.
I always move away from the just this or just that, so I'm kind of reluctant to take the view that we just need to reduce 6% our travel and that will solve the problem. Because in one way, travel is not an enemy. Travel is a good thing. Traveling is meeting people, is learning, experiencing different cultures, brings us together as a humanity, if you want. The problem with travel are the emissions. So the focus should be on the emissions, not on the good action per se. Waste is a different story. So we need to change behavior on waste, single-use plastic or all the things that we dump. That's a different story. But the travel and living, and especially because at the moment the people that travel are a small part of the global population, just like the people who have access to electricity or to power and live in comfortable houses is a small part of the global population. We still have 8 billion people, of which at least almost 1 billion have no access to electricity at all, and the remaining 6 billion, so let's say that we are in the top of 1 billion, but the remaining 6 billion in between the extremes are trying to get to a standard of living which requires more energy and more power, and that is a good thing. So the problem is the emissions. So when we talk about the behavior change, I think we need to be more nuanced than the easy solution of, we just have to travel less, so we just have to go less on holiday.
I agree with you completely, but it's a cumulative effect of all of these things, isn't it? So you've got the technology change, you've got the reduction in GHGs because you're using alternative sources of power, fuels, you've got behavioural change. What I'm thinking is I really react quite harshly against this kind of binary mindset that you've spoken about earlier as well, the and or the must be one, black or white, we can't travel, or if we do travel, everything needs to be alternative fuels for planes will are the answers, and if we don't have that, then we can't use aircraft and all the rest of it. I react badly to that. I just don't believe that, and I think what we've got is a situation where people are actually instilling a lot of anxiety in normal people who are going to have to kind of like get their heads around this, because people are going to have to support the changes. You're going to have to bring people with us on the changes.
I totally agree. I as I said before, I think, and I think there's opportunity there. This is where, you know, with a catapult, obviously, you know, the same with, you know, Luca and the team, you know, working with some great businesses who want to develop solutions that work for people and that are going to give people value. And I think what we need, as you say, is almost this help people to get behind the vision, the ambition, help them to see the benefits that might be on offer. And then for businesses and industry to deliver great solutions that they kind of really make them want to connect with it and want to do things and want to take action. I think sometimes this idea that we're all going to be forced, that somebody's going to, you know, my behavior personally gets changed when I see something that makes me think, oh, wouldn't it be great if I did that? Or actually, I really shouldn't do that, should I actually? So therefore, I won't do that. Or I'll, I want that. Or I'll go and spend my money on that rather than that. You know, I will make a choice to kind of travel that way rather than that way because it's better for me. It's more convenient. The health benefits, you know. So I think if we can try and it's probably an element of all of those things coming together. You know, and in the UK, we've got some great businesses. We've got some great innovators that really, you know, have some great ideas about how we can tackle some of these solutions, have some great technologies, have some great, you know, and also we have great sort of relationships and partnerships. I think one of the things we're great at in the UK is bringing people together to try and bring the best out and solve problems. So I do think there's, you know, there's as much cause for sort of hope as there is sort of kind of concern.
And on that note of optimism and the concept of bringing people together, it is 45 days to COP at the time we are recording this. So are we optimistic? Is that bringing people together, make some changes, drive some action? What's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a really difficult, I guess, you know, in a global pandemic, you know, where obviously, you know, many countries, you know, including the UK, and you know, are grappling with, you know, some quite pressing immediate challenges. But I think it does represent an opportunity to kind of reconnect globally on the issue, to be able to kind of set out the direction of travel. It represents an opportunity for the UK to make commitments and to demonstrate what it wants to have happen and the role that it wants to play and the activity that it's doing, the commitments it's making. So I think there's huge challenges, you know, and whether, you know, the extent to which, you know, I really hope, would like to see that from it provides the springboard, it provides a catalyst for action activity, you know, and in the context of kind of COVID, we're maybe able to use some of the lessons from managing a global pandemic and say, actually, how can we take the learning from that and apply that to how the world evolves, take maybe some of the emissions benefits that we've seen and say, well, how actually are we going to, you know, the cuts that we've seen in these places, how can we, you know, people seem to have been okay with that. How can we carry that across? So hopefully it'll provide a springboard. You know, we will see, Luca, as you know, obviously it's all about how people come, and the commitments that people are kind of willing to kind of bring to bear there as well.
What about you, Luca? Are you optimistic?
I am, because I think we have to be optimistic. You know, being optimistic doesn't necessarily make it happen, but being pessimistic definitely make it not happen. So, you know, it might be progress, and progress is progress. You know, progress made at COP will not satisfy everybody. Some people might be not thinking that it's not enough. Some people think that has been a lot. But as I said, I think it's a great opportunity, and I really hope we make some progress. I'm actually confident we will make some progress.
Good. I think I'm optimistic about our ability to think in a systems way when it comes to the technocrats of the world, you know, who will look at, well, the entire system and say, right, okay, we need to change it. You know, all the nodes need to be looked at. But what I'm not optimistic about is the nature of the debate in the public sphere. I think it's for me, it's far too black and white. It's far too binary. It's far too divisive and anxiety inducing. And I think if I could wish for something for this COP, I would wish for a more balanced, nuanced systems approach to that debate rather than the binary debate that we've seen up until now.
Yeah. I think I totally concur, sort of, Steve. And I think You know, the one sort of other lens I press point is sometimes, you know, there does need to be a sense of whether it be fear or concern to actually drive a kind of recognition of the issue. And I hope that we're in the phase of where actually that kind of, as you say, quite binary, oh, this is going to be really bad, or it's going to be, you know, or my counter view that it's going to be really great for us. We can find great ways through it, that sort of concern for change escalates up the debate. And then that leads to action, decisions, and things moving forward from a kind of political and a governmental sense. So, you know, and sometimes you need something to kind of trigger that, and it might be that provides that sort of catalyst for that.
Yeah, like Old Testament prophets in the desert, like Jeremiah, saying we're all doomed.
Indeed, and sometimes that's what's needed, isn't it? You know, I sort of. Mm-hmm. You think back to some of the public health messages that used to come out many years ago, and they were very alarmist. They were very, but they did also lead to interventions and action as a result in due course. So there's probably something in that.
Super, great. Well, thank you so much, Luca and Richard. It's been a fascinating discussion. I sat here, listened, rapt to it because you've covered so much ground. Richard, thank you so much, and all power to your elbow in terms of your work at. The Energy Systems Catapult.
Yeah, thanks both.
This podcast is brought to you by the Net Zero Technology Centre. Our purpose is to develop and deploy technology for an affordable net zero energy industry. We want to connect people, start discussions, and generate ideas to help provide solutions for our industry. So, listen, subscribe, and if you have any questions, please get in touch with us via our website at netzerotc.com. It's an exciting time in our industry, so please take it all in and get involved.